Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going
to
find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Welcome, 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 everyone, to Wall Street Unspun. My name is Neeraj Chaudhary. I'm an investment consultant with Euro Pacific Capital, the Los Angeles branch. And big to be with you here today. Peter Schiff will be joining us a bit later during the program. He just got back from an investment conference in the Bahamas hosted by Mark Skousen, and we'll be very interested to get a report from him. Meanwhile, on the home front, it's been another interesting week. I would say that, you know, as I've said on this program many times, the Chinese have a saying, may you live in interesting times. And this is where we are, folks. We are living in the most interesting times probably since the end of World War II, at least financially speaking. Immediately after World War II, of course, the United States was a great, great industrial power. We had a stranglehold on the world market for manufactured goods. Unfortunately, of course, there were some reasons for that. The rest of the world had kind of blown itself up during World War II, and so the United States was in effect the last man standing, and it took a generation for the rest of the world to rebuild its infrastructure and its manufacturing capacity into the late 1960s. And it was really in the late 1960s that the first sort of cracks started to show in the foundation of the U.S. economy. It was at that time when Lyndon Johnson tried to fight the Vietnam War and launch the Great Society at the same time. We ended up running some enormous budget deficits. By the late 1960s, the French in particular, but many central bankers and central governments around the world started demanding that we provide them our gold, because we were at that time on the gold standard. Remember, the gold standard is what keeps us in check. It keeps any central bank and central government, from being able to just go out and print their own currency recklessly. Well, unfortunately, because we were spending those monies at home and abroad in the 1960s, the Federal Reserve did in fact monetize those deficits. And by 1971, the drain on our nation's gold supply was so dramatic that it forced President Nixon to take us off the gold standard. And in reality, since 1971, since we have gotten off the gold standard, every action that has been taken by the federal government and the Federal Reserve have been increasingly building us towards a bubble economy, increasing levels of debt, funded by too much cheap money, very low interest rates that allows these speculative bubbles to develop. And then obviously there's a bursting of the bubble and a deflationary bust in real terms, in terms of gold, but an inflationary bust because there is no restriction on the Federal Reserve to limit its balance sheet. The Federal Reserve's balance sheet has tripled to over $2 trillion. And they say that this spring the Federal Reserve will wind down its monetization of securities. To be perfectly honest with you, I don't buy it. I just don't buy it. And the reason is that going forward, we are running these enormous deficits. There is simply nobody out there to buy this debt. The Chinese are catching on to what we're doing here. They're increasingly turning their focus inward, and it is getting to be increasingly difficult to maintain these deficits. The Federal Reserve will not have a choice but to step in, become the buyer of last resort. And when you have a central government running deficits and you have a central bank monetizing those deficits, that is the road to inflation, hyperinflation. And unfortunately, the events of the past couple of years with the Federal Reserve and the central and the federal government coming in, spending lots of money, the Federal Reserve blowing up its balance sheet to unprecedented levels, only serves to demonstrate what the concerns that Peter has had for many, many, many years. This is something that he has seen coming, and unfortunately for our fellow citizens in the United States, all these things are slowly coming to pass. I'd like to give you the phone number to call in. We have many callers waiting. The phone number is 888-678-9597. It's a very nice day here in Los Angeles, and I hope that it is the same where you are as well. There are a couple of things that caught my attention in the news this week. One of them, probably the most important piece of news that I picked up on and that really I didn't really see discussed in the mainstream media, as good as they are, was that the SEC now has the power to halt redemptions of money market funds if they deem that market conditions warrant it. This literally just happened very recently, and it's a new SEC regulation that that allows the SEC to halt redemptions of money market funds. Well, everyone always kind of chastises people who talk about exchange and capital controls and limits on liquidity, limits on withdrawals, bank runs, things like that. But, folks, this is the first step in that process. I can very easily see the Treasury or the SEC or some combination thereof, perhaps even in conjunction with the Federal Reserve, if the rest of the world gets wind of the fact that the Fed is monetizing these deficits, the Treasury and the Federal Reserve coming out and saying, well, in order to maintain stability for the banking system, we are going to prevent the convertibility of U.S. dollars into foreign currency. Well, guess what that means? That means that you can't get your dollars out of the country. They're basically kind of holding them hostage, and that will be one means that they will use to try and continue to fund these deficits. Now, we don't know if that's going to happen or not. We certainly hope that it does not. I certainly hope that it does not, because it would be devastating for the country. But when you see the SEC implement a new regulation that allows them to halt the redemption of money market funds, which historically have been known as a highly, highly liquid vehicle, it's kind of one of the core foundational principles of a money market fund is that it's liquid. That's the whole idea, that the reason that people went into money market funds in the first place. So the idea that they would take away that liquidity from money market funds is very, very disappointing and portends possibly future issues. This kind of regulatory encroachment is a bit of a slippery slope. Every year or every couple of years, we come out with a new regulation. We try to build a patch upon previously patched regulations. And really, the root of all these problems is the fact that we have a system with a fiat currency that allows people to engage in what they call morally hazardous behavior, where the risks are all socialized. The taxpayers are bearing the risks for all these banks that have lost all this money. But when their stock prices were going up and when the bonuses were being handed out, these folks participated in all the upside and kind of left us holding the bill for this party. It's very disappointing. I hate to see it because in the end, I think that it is going to be our fellow citizens, ourselves and our fellow citizens, that are going to be footing the bill for this party that the industry has been on for several decades. And unfortunately, we do not see good things on the horizon when we see the SEC involved in this kind of increasingly encroaching regulation. But all that doom and gloom notwithstanding, There are good things happening in the world. In Asia, we see kind of a flowering and a birth of a new kind of capitalism. It does not exactly mimic Western capitalism, but it's a very, very dynamic region. And actually, one of my colleagues, my assistant branch manager in the Los Angeles branch, a gentleman who has hosted this program in the past as well, his name is John Downs, he has recently taken the opportunity to actually move to China, to move to Shanghai for an extended period, to immerse himself in business conditions there and to immerse himself in the opportunities there. He's going to be attending several investment conferences in conjunction with our capital markets folks. And I'm very pleased to introduce him onto the program. John Downs, how are you today?
Ni hao.
Yeah, ni hao, ni hao. How are you?
I'm getting the day started here as I jump on this call, Niraj. I'm overlooking the city of Shanghai from the 18th floor of the Carey Residences, looking at a new hotel going up right across the street from me. Cranes are moving, three of them actually. Five on this construction site alone, and just about any building or any direction you look at, that's the first thing that really stands out. You know, they say 70% of the world's construction cranes are currently located in Shanghai. And, boy, I can tell you firsthand that's true. I mean, it is amazing the, the amount of construction that's going on in every single direction and the dichotomy between, where we see, I look to my left, I see, an old kind of a, I don't want to say a thatch roof, but just a really old, shoddy shanty looking building, and then right next to it is the Shanghai Exhibition Center with a parking lot full of, really brand new cars. And that's one thing that has stood out. I know that I've mentioned in the past to many of my clients, the little fact, and this is probably pretty well known, China is the world's largest car market, overtaking the U.S. in 2009. And, boy, I tell you, there's no clunkers on the road. I guess they've already done their cash for clunkers. There's no clunkers on the road here. Everything is really new and gleaming, with the exception of the scooter mafia. I'm telling you, they have not yet begun purchasing the scooters with the same, the same pace that they're purchasing the cars. You really got to watch yourself crossing the street here, or you will get mowed down by scooters from, I think, the last few decades that were being built. So, but it's something else. I've only been in Shanghai for a couple days. As you mentioned, the reason that I came over here, there's a Chinese investment conference that we're attending in March. Had the opportunity to, as I've been studying Mandarin for the last month or so, to really take the opportunity to come over here, as you said, immerse myself into the business conditions and really just the culture. I think it adds a depth of experience to spend time in another country, especially here at this point in time, Asia being really the centerpiece of world economic growth. Wanted to see it, experience it firsthand. I'm going to spend the majority of my time in Shanghai. In April, actually, Peter will be speaking at an investment conference here in Shanghai as well, and himself, Gordon McBean, will be over here, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity to travel a little bit more broadly throughout the country at that time. And my hope is that we have several growth stocks, IPOs that we've done in capital markets, as many of our clients are aware. We'd like to tour the facilities, really take the opportunity to go around and see firsthand, or I would like to take the opportunity to see firsthand a lot of the things that our analysts, our capital markets team has already really investigated, and hopefully we can take that back, this experience back to our Euro-Pacific capital clients. And so I tell you, it's something else. I apologize to anybody in advance if I appear a little off. The jet lag is still kind of with me, and then more than anything, I tell you, I got to thank my girlfriend Tiffany, who the day before I left, we were in the shopping mall looking for things, kind of buying the travel size shampoo and all that stuff. She said, maybe you should take this box of Nutri-Grain bars. You don't really know how accessible food and restaurants, what it's going to be like when you get there. And I've been living on Nutri-Grain bars for about the last 48 hours. I'm down to my very last one. I would love a hamburger. And I thought, last night I'd have that opportunity. I went to McDonald's, actually, as I was in the McDonald's. I said, I'd be a little healthy. I'll get a chicken sandwich. And I don't think they've heard of the all-white meat chicken breast sandwich at the McDonald's here in Shanghai. It wasn't exactly the most tasty fare, but everyone says it's hit or miss. But just like anything, when you're experiencing a new place, you kind of got to take the convenient with the inconvenience. So Hopefully
John,
today I'll be able to go by.
Tell us about the people there. You know, one of the things that I like to hear about in the past times when I've hosted the show, I'd love to hear from international callers because I like to hear the energy and the dynamism of the people. Tell us a little about the people there.
You know, I think everyone's, you know, would tell you that the Chinese people are generally very friendly. Everyone that I've met has been very friendly. You know, as I've gone up and try to practice my rudimentary Mandarin, oftentimes I'll just be interrupted with a smile and a little bit of, you know, broken English and kind of get where I'm going or do what I have to do. So very friendly. But more than anything, everyone is so young. I mean, just extremely. I was on the subway last night as I was going to Nanjing Road to do a little bit of shopping, and I was looking for, you know, I forgot my running shoes. By the way, there's no size 13 running shoes in China. So if you have a big foot, you know, make sure you take care of your footwear before you come. And you know, so as I was there and as I was on the subway, I'm looking around, and everyone seems to be in their 20s. I mean, I wouldn't hardly say there was anyone in their 30s on the subway. And I mean, this is just kind of the general theme as I look around, as I walk around. There's just a general youth throughout the. I understand that's indicative here to downtown Shanghai where I'm staying, but that's the first thing that stands out. The life that they're living. I mean, the pollution. It's all over the place. You know how it is when you go somewhere new. I mean, my mind is just running a million miles a minute. But I'll just kind of walk you through as I showed up. I showed up at the airport. Not yesterday, but the day before, about 5:45. You know, it was virtually empty. I mean, we're not very occupied. I would say there was, you know, just very well staffed with security. Very quickly went through customs. Was not, you know, a very long line. But went out, went onto a brand new highway complex. I mean, an elevated highway. There were no, you know, just completely. Shanghai is going to host the World Expo this summer. So there's been a lot of construction around the airport, which was architecturally magnificent. I haven't looked online and understood any of the statistics. So I don't know what went into building it, but just the architecture in the airport was amazing. The highway, you know, broad, you know, four-lane highway. You know, every car was new, hardly any traffic until we got down into central Shanghai. And, boy, if you've ever ridden a cab in New York, you really haven't experienced anything because riding in a cab in Shanghai, there's just not a lot of, obeying any traffic laws if they even have them. I mean, you're just all over the place. But we made it safe and sound. You know, my cab driver, fortunately, didn't take offense that I think I told him I was here to eat the Chinese people in Mandarin. So got to know him a little bit. You know, he was very, optimistic. And I think that's been a general theme as well from the people that I've talked to, as I just kind of mentioned, their lives and their livelihoods. There's just a general gleam in the eye as they think about the future and as they speak about it. To me, particularly, you know, there's certainly the impression I have is, you know, the times are changing, and I think they realize, at least, you know, the few people I've spoken to realize that they're at the forefront. One of the amazing images as I you know, got into my residence, you know, I turn on the television. Unfortunately, I'm blessed. I have satellite TV here, and so I, you know, immediately turn it on to the Chinese news station, and you know, it's interesting because Peter talked about in Crash Proof how anytime you know, we show the you'll have a news anchor talking and the images in the background, if it's something about America, you know, you kind of see the retail, you know, they'll show the images of consumers buying, you know, the cash registers ringing. These are the things that you see. You know, then they show the images of Asia and you see the factories and the big trucks and, you know, the things that, you know, see, that's kind of where the manufacturing and the real industrial growth is occurring. And so, you know, I was really anxious to see, you know, kind of the images and what was expressed in the screen. And not within 10 minutes am I seeing American soldiers in Afghanistan. Then they flash to the you know, Chinese aircraft carrier. I think there's only one right now, but, you know, they show that. Then you see the missiles taken off, and I can't really understand what they're saying, and there's no captions. But, you know, you can kind of get the impression that they're talking about the, you know, the relations between the U.S. and China. And, you know, right after they show those rockets taken off, what's the next thing you see? You see those dollars flying off the printing press. I mean, there's the there they are, you know, the greenbacks just running through. And, you know, you can only imagine what the Chinese commentator is saying and how, you know, as a citizen of in China, you know, how that would, you know, kind of stoke some of the I'm still suffering from a little bit of a hangover from the plane, but you can just kind of see the writing on the wall. And, I'm real anxious to see how that plays out as I see firsthand, as we see with some of the images of, the Google talking about refusing to censor the websites. You know, I can't access Facebook here, not that I spend a lot of time on there anyway, but it's interesting as I run through and see the sites that are censored and what you're able to look at and what you can't, and it's interesting. It's very interesting. But the other impressions, as I come in here, the Western influence, and I think that speaks to the youth of the country as well. You go around and you're seeing the styles just like you would see in the United States. You look at the billboards, it's not just Asian or Eastern models. I mean, you see, you have Western models, you've got all the Western brands are certainly making a segue here. But it's real interesting because we talk, and I speak a lot to my clients about that. When you're playing the growth in China, how precarious would it be to be a Western brand in China, knowing that, if nationalist sentiment were to be stoked, if trade restrictions were enforced, would you want to be a Western, a Western country investing in China, or would you rather be on the ground in the companies in China so that you're not nearly as affected by those types of trade protectionism? And so you can see certainly the influence, but also, as I drive by, I see the Gomes, you see the large the large Chinese chains, and they're everywhere, and they're just as prominent as the Western brands, although I certainly understand that the Western brands might get much more play in Shanghai, being a really a global city. Other influences, it's a lot to take in.
Sounds,
that's for sure. It's really
like,
just a sensory
sounds like
overload.
A very, sounds like a very exciting and dynamic place. What I'd like to be able to do is segue and take on some callers here. We've got a gentleman, Earl, in Pennsylvania. Earl, you've been waiting very patiently, and love to be able to welcome you to the show. How are you doing today, sir?
Thank you very much. I'll get right to my question.
Sure.
With this coming possible catastrophe as far as the stock market, what they're saying with maybe the next couple of months there's going to be a big crash. Is that, it seems to me that whenever our market goes down and I look at my portfolio, and I am a client, my portfolio is down. So no matter what happens here, if something does happen here, it happens in my portfolio. It's
right.
Just a mirror image. So
Peter has actually spoken to this on many occasions. It is if you watch the way the markets work on a daily basis, you may see on a daily basis if the Dow is down a little bit, you may see the Asian markets be down. If the Dow is up some, you may see the Asian markets go up. But there are also many, many days of what we refer to as decoupling, where if the Asian market is up, you may see the Dow move down. Or if the Dow moves up, you may see the Asian market go flat. That was the case actually starting very much in November of 2008, right at the bottom, where Asia kind of hit its bottom right at the end of October of 2008 and really started coming back up and bottoming, whereas the Dow from November to March made another marginal new low. Asian markets did not make that new low. So over time, on individual days, you'll have a decoupling, and over time, that will build into a divergence. I'm reminded of an article in the New York Times. I'm afraid I don't have it in front of me right now, but there was a they kind of looked at what they called the lost decade of U.S. equities, where the Dow obviously hit about 11,000 back in 2000 and is today hovering right around that same level. Obviously, today it's a little bit lower, about 10,200. Over the period of that 10 years, the three markets that they looked at were Brazil, India, and China, were up by orders of magnitude. So on a given day, they may move together, and even for a short period of a few days, they may move together. But you'll often see a lot of decoupling in those days, and over time, you will see that divergence between how the foreign markets perform and how the U.S. markets perform. And again, I'm sorry I don't have that data in front of me, but there was a very clear chart provided in the New York Times about that divergence of performance. The other thing that's important to realize is that during that same 10-year period, you had the U.S. dollar lose 40% of its value against most major currencies as measured by the dollar index. The U.S. dollar index peaked at about 120 back in 2000 or so, and by July of 2008 had hit a low of 72, which is exactly 40%. So even though in nominal terms, if the dollar, or excuse me, if the Dow Jones moves in the same direction as some of the foreign markets on any given day or for any brief period, it's doing it in dollars that are unfortunately being consistently devalued against most major foreign currencies. The final sort of component that you should probably look at is, I don't know, how long have you been a client with us?
Just over a year.
Just over a year.
Maybe close to 2 years.
Close to 2 years, okay. So the other thing that you'll see is some of the dividend rates in foreign stocks are higher than the dividend rates in U.S. stocks. And over time, we expect that divergence to continue. The dividend yield on the S&P 500 is in the low 2% range. In many markets, it's higher. And, of course, that you should always look at the current data to get exactly what those numbers are. But it's hovering in the much lower ranges compared to foreign markets. So you kind of have to look at, instead of looking at just an individual day or a brief period of time, like a few days or a few weeks, if you look over the long term, which is really our objective, you'll see that the foreign markets have been outperforming the local market for many, many years.
Yeah, and, also from a singular starting point, if you draw two lines, one line over the next, you don't notice any difference. You just diverge. You point one line in the, even just, a tenth of 1% at a different trajectory, and given enough time, you're going to see a huge divergence. And, that divergence certainly, as it plays out in the stock market, is going to be based on real economics. And, that's the million-dollar question. At what point are real economics going to be reflected in portfolios as opposed to we see the global markets and certainly commodities and assets trading as one market? And so, Earl, to the extent that you're uneasy about a imminent pullback, I mean, it's every commentator and their brother is talking about a pullback right now. And, generally it's a good time to stop and think, okay, what is this really, if everyone can see it so clearly, the odds of it happening are much, much less. As a contrarian investor, as Peter starting out this company, I mean, people laughed in his face when he, really spoke about his investment philosophy. And that, as he's told me in the past, gave him even more strength and conviction to move in the direction that he did, because he knew that as a contrarian investor, that's where the profits would be. But I would tell you what I tell my own clients, and that is to be diversified. And to the extent, I think I heard a little bit of what Neeraj was saying as I was getting connected to the call about the money market funds and the concern now, as I've seen the commentary today, is, hey, are money market funds really safe? If they break the buck, is the government going to jump in? The idea is, and the investment banks and everybody out there wants you to believe that you're really safe just in a U.S. dollar-based money market fund, and that you could never see that value dip below. Well, that's not necessarily the case. And so, as opposed to being compliant and just sitting in a money market fund because that's what you've done in the past, what I would tell you to do is diversify into foreign currencies. I know so advocates, really just, as you read in Crash Bruises, I'm sure you did, being globally diversified. And so it's not just being in equities, in assets, it's being in currencies as well. And I would encourage anybody sitting on a big lump sum of cash right now to really examine and evaluate, do you want all your money in one currency or do you want to be diversified? And we certainly have the instruments to do that. And, if it's a time that, you feel more comfortable, I mean, you don't have the same investment timeline that I might have. I'm judging by your voice that you're probably older than 32. So, you have to do what's right for yourself. And that's one of the things that brokers here at Euro Pacific Capital will do with each individual client. What I might tell one of my clients might not be appropriate for you. Every single situation and individual is different, particularly when we're talking about the asset allocation. So, but don't be. I've seen just as many commentaries recently, just to speak to you, trading at 12.
I'm going to have to. I think your phone connection's breaking up there, and also we've got Peter joining us as well. So we want to thank you very much for taking some time out of your day in Shanghai. Please go and enjoy yourself and take out some great observations and take some great pictures, and we'll talk to you when you get back. And we're going to move on. Earl, so I just wanted to kind of close out with you. Did that kind of address some of your questions about pullbacks?
Yeah,
I've
been a client maybe a year and a half, 2 years.
Okay.
I've watched fairly closely. I do see the markets, you know, just imitating. I can understand what you're saying. Maybe over a longer period of time. I'm anxious to see a decoupling and things stabilizing, but that's a tall order, I guess.
Well, I think that again, if you compare the as John was referring to just before we closed him out, you know, the economic growth is really taking place overseas. The Chinese, even though they're going to quote unquote slow down this year, well, sure, they're going to slow down from 10% to 8%. We got a sugar high, if you will, in the fourth quarter of about 5.7%, but final demand in the United States was really only up a couple of percentage points. So, you know, looking at the fundamental economic growth, it's really taking place overseas. And looking ahead, that fundamental economic growth, the savings in production, is going to continue to drive their GDP growth rates much higher. And as that GDP growth rate continues to outpace that what's taking place in the United States, you know, this is a long-term strategy, and we are very, very interested and excited about the opportunities overseas. Thank you very much, Earl, for your call. Appreciate it. And I'm going to switch it over to Peter. If you all will hold on for just a moment, we're going to have Peter join us. Be right back with you.
Okay. Hey, everybody. It's Peter. I just got back. I was at a Republican a town committee meeting in Derby. And I know John Downs was on the line. I heard a little bit of what he said. I know he's in China right now. Hopefully he's having a little fun, learning a little bit more firsthand about some of the things that are happening in one of the countries where we're investing so much money. But anyway, I thank John for participating in the show. I know he's up was up early in the morning in Hong Kong to get ready for this. And also, I know Nurge is on the line. I think, Nurge, are you still with us?
I am, Peter. Good to hear your voice.
Right.
How are you doing? You sound a little under the weather. You doing all right?
Yeah, I still got this cough. It's coming back. You know, I can't seem to get rid of this thing. I took a round of antibiotics. I took the whole thing of cough syrup. I still got some inhaler. I got to call the doctor and go back to the drawing board because I cannot get rid of it. And I've had it now. I was sick for like one day, and then the cough has stayed with me for a long time.
Well, fortunately, you're going to have some government-run health care that's going to take good care of you, and you'll be fine, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'll end up dying of my cough if I had to rely on the government to cure it. But, let's, you know, the stuff I want to talk about a little bit, and then, you know, we can take some phone calls. I don't necessarily see any calls on hold right now. I don't know if that means we don't have any or what, but we can take calls, 888-678-9597. Oh, now I'm hearing no calls. Oh, I didn't know that. We got word just the other day on Monday about the new fiscal 2011 budget. The federal government is spending $3.8 trillion. Now, I don't even think we should call this thing a budget, because the government's only collecting, and I say only because it still seems like a lot of money for us to pay in taxes. The government is only collecting $2.4 trillion in taxes, which means $1.4 trillion is being borrowed and spent. And to really put that in perspective, for every dollar the government collects in taxes, they're spending $1.60. What kind of budget is that? That's not even in the realm of being a budget. It's so far off the charts that they need to go back to the drawing board. How can you spend $1.60 when you only have a dollar? The government has to reduce spending dramatically in line with its income. And, you know, I was in my town meeting today. You know, I mentioned that we needed to shrink government, including, you know, eliminating departments and laying off government workers. And one woman's response was, well, wouldn't that simply add to the unemployment problem? One of the reasons that so many people are unemployed in the private sector is because we've got too many people employed in the government sector, and we're strangling the private sector to be able to afford all these government workers. But the problem is the government jobs are not the productive jobs that we need. The more people that are working in government, the harder it is for the private sector to finance it. So unfortunately, there are going to be some people who are going to lose their jobs in government as they transition to more productive employment in the private sector. Some people might say, well, how are they going to find jobs when there's so many people already unemployed? Well, if we can cut government, there won't be as many people unemployed because businesses will be able to grow. Their taxes won't have to be as high. Maybe regulations won't be as burdensome. And businesses will be able to expand. Right now they can't because the resources needed to expand them are being diverted to the government. We need to free those resources back up. You know, in the final analysis, the government can give everybody a job. The government can create jobs because the government can give everybody a job. But what the government can't create is purchasing power. And if everybody had a government job, everybody would be employed, but everybody would be broke. And, you know, the point is not to have a job, but to have purchasing power. And we're not going to get that from government. We're going to get that from the private sector. And it's not going to happen until the government sets it free, which means we got to take a meat hook to the federal spending. And, you know, President Obama is claiming that these big budget deficits are going to come down over time. They're not going to come down. They're just going to get worse. Because the economy is going to keep getting worse, which means the tax revenues are going to shrink. They're not going to grow. And the government expenditures are going to grow. They're not going to shrink. So the budget deficit is going to get worse and worse the farther into the future you go until this whole thing comes collapsing down. Now, also what happened last week is the Senate, unfortunately, reconfirmed Ben Bernanke to another reign of terror, another four-year term. But I'm sure that Ben Bernanke had to make all sorts of promises to the senators with respect to how much money he would print to buy up all the bonds that they're going to have to sell to finance all the spending that they need to get reelected. And I don't think it's a coincidence that on the same day that we reconfirmed Ben Bernanke that the federal government raised the debt ceiling by about $2 trillion because they know that they need Ben Bernanke's cooperation. Because a $2 trillion deficit needs the Federal Reserve to finance it. Now, if I was Fed chairman, I would tell Congress to pound sand. I wouldn't buy any of that $2 trillion. I would let interest rates go up, and I would force our politicians to act responsibly. But they don't have to act responsibly because they got their partner in crime, Ben Bernanke, that's going to do their dirty work. And that's not what we want. We want an independent Federal Reserve to stand up to these politicians. Of course, if we simply had politicians with some integrity, we wouldn't need the Federal Reserve to chaperone them. But unfortunately, you know, Americans are being failed on every level. Their elected officials are failing them. Their central bankers are failing them. The judges are failing them. Nobody is holding anybody accountable. It is just a free-for-all out there in Washington, D.C., where all these politicians and central bankers, all they look out is for themselves. And they don't care how much damage they do to this economy. As long as they can stay in power, that's all they care about. And we need to bring a change. And now I see all these calls lighting up on the board, so I guess it means that we can take calls. So who's first up? I guess it's going to be Johnny in Connecticut, a potential constituent of mine and hopefully a Peter Schiff voter and volunteer. Go ahead, Johnny.
Hey, absolutely. You have my full support. I had a question for you. Speaking of the Fed, you know, they had these currency swaps that they started back in late 2008 with other central banks. And I believe recently they're starting to unwind some of those swaps. Is that correct?
I'm not really sure. I hadn't heard so much about what they're doing with respect to currency swaps. But do you have a point with respect to how that might impact exchange rates or interest rates?
Well, exactly. How it would impact the dollar. You know, I'm reading some economists saying that the dollar may go up in value because now there will be fewer dollars sweeping around the world and other central banks once they reverse these currency swap lines. And some of these swap lines are with European Central Bank, the Swiss, and the Bank of England and things like that. Another counter argument would be that the dollar would actually go down because so many of these dollars would come flooding back into our system. What is your take on that?
Well, I mean, coming back into our system would put maybe upward pressure on prices in the United States as dollars came back to bid up prices here. But I don't think that even if these swaps are unwound, the question is, you know, global dollar supply still seems to be increasing because of our trade deficits, which continue to put more dollars into global circulation. And I still think that there are a lot of entities like foreign central banks that, you know, may be trying to, you know, unload some of their dollars in favor of other assets. And so I think net-net, I still think that there's, you know, that dollars are not becoming scarce, that, you know, there is a growing supply of dollars on the global market, and that should drive the price down. You know, in the short run, I mean, the dollar can go in any direction. I mean, we've already had a decent rally. If you look at the dollar index, which had, you know, gotten down to about 73 or so, you know, not too long ago, a couple months ago, now is back above 79. So we've had a, you know, 8% or so rally in the dollar from its low point, you know, from it's still, you know, relatively low based on historic exchange rates. But, you know, it's moved up and it's moved up during a period of time where it should have been moving down, because really anybody who understands the fundamentals for the dollar in the U.S. economy would have to have a very bleak outlook for the U.S. currency.
Oh, absolutely. The supply is so huge now. I mean, are we causing bubbles in other parts of the world because of this money?
Yeah, I mean, I think that certainly in countries like China, you know, or, you know, where money supply is also growing very rapidly because their currencies are pegged to ours and their interest rates are too low, you have malinvestments that are being created. And, yes, I believe we are the source of that, the fact that other central banks are being forced to mimic our irresponsible monetary policy is we are exporting inflation and you know, misallocations of resources and bubbles into other economy. The question is, how large will some of those bubbles be allowed to inflate before, you know, foreign central banks take action? It seems to me that in China, they're already doing something about it. We'll see, you know, how committed they are and what kind of a difference it makes.
Now, I just have one quick question, a little bit unrelated. But in one of your books, you mentioned that one of your favorite ways of investing, at least physical silver, is through buying the bags of junk silver. Why is that in particular?
Well, you know, I think that the coins, you know, obviously if you're going to buy millions of dollars worth of silver, that's not the most convenient way to do it. But to the extent that you're going to have some money in silver, I think those are very good coins because they're very easily recognizable by Americans as what they are. And, you know, and to the extent that we end up bartering our silver for other goods and services, I think that, you know, having, you know, dimes and half dollars, quarters, you know, concentrates some value in a small unit, and you know, it's easy to exchange them, and people know what they are. And they're also, to the extent that the government confiscates gold or silver, maybe those coins might be exempted as, you know, they're changed, they're legal, it's legal tender here in the United States. I don't know if the government's going to say that, you know, you need to surrender your quarters, you know, or your nickel or your dime. So, you know, you might have a layer of protection there.
All right. Well, thank you. And I just want to let you know we recently opened an account at Euro Pacific and working through your Westport office.
Oh, well, that's where I am, so that's good to have you on board.
All right. Thanks very much for answering my question.
Thanks for calling. Next up is going to be Jeff in New York.
Hey, Peter. Can you hear me?
Hey, Jeff.
Yeah, hi. This is Jeff from New York. I've been following your radio show for a while, and so I have the same with many other economists and other people talking about the political situation. And I was wondering how you feel about the future of the U.S. I mean, you talk a lot about the economy, but I'm concerned about the political situation in the United States, and also if we're going to have hyperinflation. Throughout history, that typically wasn't a pretty event where it took place. It was often combined with violence, with war, with genocide. And I wonder how you think about this, and if you could give us your perspective on what you're expecting.
Yeah, I mean, hyperinflation is certainly a worst-case scenario. I am hoping to avoid that situation in the United States. And I know it. I still believe that it is avoidable. It's just that our politicians are going to have to make some serious changes in, you know, what they've been doing. Because so far, everything that they've been doing is precisely what would result in hyperinflation happening if these policies are pursued to the nth degree. To the extent that we're able to successfully avoid hyperinflation is going to be a function of our ability to abandon these policies and to pursue pretty much the exact opposite policies than the ones that we're, you know, currently implementing. And, you know, it's certainly not impossible for our elected leaders to do an about face, you know, particularly if I'm in the Senate, you know, helping them see the light. But, you know, even without my help, they can still come to these conclusions. But it's hard to know exactly how to handicap this thing as to what the probability are, what the probabilities is that we end up in hyperinflation, because that I think that will be the worst case scenario economically.
But you're certainly saying that it doesn't look like we're doing anything against hyperinflation, and we have
No. Right now, everything we're doing is leading to it. We have
exactly.
to come to our senses, recognize the mistakes that we're making, and then act to correct them before it's too late. And it's a self, you know, it's on autopilot. You know, we got to make sure it doesn't happen.
I just heard a statistic, and I don't know if it's accurate, but it was saying that the current administration spent more than all previous administrations combined. And this is
I don't know if that's possible. They've only been spending money for 1 year.
Exactly.
And so,
I
think if you probably, though, count a lot of the debts that have been assumed, you know, through Freddie and Fannie or things of that nature, if you want to include that, then maybe that could be his true statement. I mean, you know, if you assume, you know, look
Peter,
at all the additional unfunded liabilities that have been
exactly.
that have been put on the books, but they haven't physically spent that money yet, but they may have committed future taxpayers to footing those bills.
I mean, I'm not an economist, so I can't really predict whether we are going to have hyperinflation or something a little bit better than hyperinflation. But do you have any fears besides the economical outlook on the political situation? Do you have any?
Oh, yeah. I mean, certainly I am fearful. You know, the worse the economy gets, the easier it is for governments to remove our rights and to usurp more power for themselves, because the government can always promise an end to the misery, an end to the suffering. The government promises to protect us. And so governments strive on bad economic times. So it is very dangerous. You know, your liberties really come under assault when times are tough. During prosperity, when things are good, it's very difficult for the government to usurp that kind of power because the people are able to withstand that. But when people are suffering, it makes it easier for government to promise relief in exchange for our liberties, you know, our rights, and just giving them more power to do good. But unfortunately, government doesn't do good with power. It does evil. And the more power they have, the more evil they do. And so, yeah, we have to be concerned about what could happen in an environment of hyperinflation, because it is going to be very, very disruptive to the lives of average Americans. And, you know, there could be civil unrest. There could be looting and rioting. A lot of things could happen in that environment, because that's what's happened in other nations that have experienced that type of an economic event.
Maybe just one quick question to finish up.
Actually, let me let you go, because it's 8:53. Okay. I've only got 7 minutes left. I didn't realize. I want to just get to all the callers. The last caller, I think, is Michelle in Michigan.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, Michelle. Go ahead. Your last caller tonight.
Thanks. I first want to say I sympathize with you about your cold and respiratory infection. My husband and daughter are, like, going through the same thing for, like, it seems like 2 months now, and antibiotics, inhalers, and yeah. Now they've both been diagnosed with asthma, and who knows whether that's right. So.
But anyway, thank you. Well, let's get to your questions so we don't bore all of our listeners with our medical problems.
Right. Hey, you know, I've been – you know, just dumbfounded by this rally in this market since March. You know, it just keeps going up and going up and going up. And, you know, someone's putting money into the market. And I even heard some guy today say they don't know where the money's coming from. Retail investors aren't putting their money in. Net inflows into the equity mutual funds have been negative. You know, do you think the Federal Reserve is involved in any way and maybe manipulating a way to make this market keep going up?
Well, and I mean, like, look, the Federal Reserve is certainly influencing the market with their interest rate policy and by their open market operations to buy up securities. So the Federal Reserve is definitely a big part in the market. It's supplying the liquidity that was necessary to lift the market. But the market has been falling recently. If you haven't been watching it, the Dow was above 10,700 a couple of weeks ago, and it almost traded down to 10,000 a couple of days ago. So we've given up about, I'd say, 6% from the peak price in the last couple of weeks. So, you know, it's been going down. The question is going to be, are we going to keep going down, or are we going to resume the uptrend that has been in place since March of last year in the U.S. and since October of 2008 in emerging markets and commodities and precious metals and things like that. My tendency is to think that the upward trends will remain intact for a while longer because the liquidity is still driving these markets. The government is creating inflation, debasing our money. And the result of that is that, you know, prices of things, when you price them in a debased money, the prices will rise. But it's not really that much of a reflection of, you know, stocks getting more valuable as it is money getting less valuable.
Yeah, it's just that, you know, the inflows into bond funds have been huge. You can see where it seems like every individual's money.
Yeah, well, I don't know if individuals are buying bonds. I know a lot of financial institutions are buying bonds, and that's the problem. You know, banks are buying bonds instead of loaning money to businesses. They're buying government bonds, and so that's not helping the economy. It's, you know, it's helping the government expand, but that's causing the economy to contract. I think central banks, both in a U.S. central bank and foreign central banks, they're buying bonds and creating inflation to do it. But
right.
I don't know. I don't know how many private individuals are that dumb with their own money that they're going to buy. They're going to lend money to the United States government for 30 years and expect 4.5% and accept 4.5% interest.
Well, the problem is a lot of the money, though, is in 401k plans where you don't have a choice. You have to go into government securities or you have to go into an income fund.
That might be true.
You know, that's what worries me.
But, yeah, I know. I've heard some rumors or some people are afraid that the government's going to have some kind of, you know, force conversion or requirement to try to force Americans to buy government bonds through their retirement funds and or through government-provided annuities or something. And who knows?
I mean, as the pretty much what's available now. You don't even get money anymore. I happen to be an investment advisor, and I look over 401k plans a lot. And you don't get money market funds anymore. You only get, like, government securities fund or, like, a corporate bond fund.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets more risky. So it's like you have no place to park your cash. Nowhere.
Right, but these – I'm sure these government funds are more short-term. They're not, like – they're not 10, 20, 30-year maturity bonds. They're probably – you know, like a government money market fund, kind of like all short term stuff.
Yeah, well, and then a lot of them are the income funds with those insurance companies. How safe do you think those are?
I don't think they're safe at all because
I don't
think they're safe because I think either some of these companies go bankrupt or the government prints a lot of money to bail them out. Either way, either they default on your policy. Or your policy has little value because of all the inflation that was created to keep the insurance companies solvent.
Right.
So, look, I don't think any investments
plans,
in the U.S.
That's all they're offering for a cash investment. There's no place to go in all this retirement money.
I got an email about that from somebody saying if I get elected to the Congress, is that something I can help do? I think there should be a law that allows people who have money in employer plans to opt out of those plans and not have to – you know, cash out, but roll over into an IRA. Right now, you can't roll your retirement money into an IRA unless you resign your employment. You can't continue your employment and still protect your assets. And that just seems wrong. You know, if your employer doesn't give you the right investment choices, you should be able to take your money out of that plan and move it without any tax consequences into a plan that you direct so you can invest the money in the right choices.
That's right. I absolutely agree. That is something that needs to be done. And,
hey, anyway, that's it.
Anyone else,
the music is playing. I got to let you go,
early,
Michelle. Thanks for your call. Anybody, thanks, everybody. I'm sorry I wasn't here for the whole show, but I know George and Nurge and John Downs would have done a great job, so I thank them. I thank everybody for listening.
On a housekeeping note, just wanted to let everybody know that our processes have changed for posting these radio shows to the website, so there will be a few days worth of delay before
that's all thanks to compliance and more rules and regulations that make it harder to get. It's not because we want to, but it's government regulations that's forcing us to scrutinize these things more. But anyway, don't forget to call 800-727-7922 to talk to a broker. Pick up a copy of Crash Proof 2.0. And remember, all investment strategies carry risks, so make sure to look thoroughly at all the risks before you invest money in any particular strategy. Thanks, everybody, for listening.